The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Helping make it all possible is the generous partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell a friend to go to Town Hall Review and sign up as well today. It may be true that more than 1,000 books have been written on Winston Churchill, the statesman of the 20th century. Churchill is, of course, remembered for his heroic leadership, which saved Great Britain from annihilation in World War II. But how many know that Churchill was a hands-on soldier in 5 separate campaigns on 4 different continents? Distinguished British historian Andrew Roberts spent 4 years writing his masterpiece volume, aptly titled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. My friend Dennis Prager invited Roberts on his show to talk about it.
Andrew Roberts, the great historian, and he is a great historian, British historian. Latest book, which I just finished. It is I want you to know, Andrew Roberts, I felt that I was living with Churchill reading your book.
Thank you very much indeed, Dennis. That's about the nicest thing that a reader can say.
It is the nicest. Yes, that's right. He was part of my life. I feel after reading your book that I know him. That's really the best thing I think one can say. Did you learn him doing this, or did it just fill in details of what you already assumed about him?
Oh, no, I learned a great deal when I was... there were all sorts of areas of about him that I didn't really know about when I started the research of this. Of course, I'd heard and understood, I think, the big things about him, but the number of small details that sort of lend so much colour to him, I didn't really know those until I'd worked on this, as I say, for 4 years.
I came away, the book, ladies and gentlemen, is up at DennisPrager.com. It's Churchill, Walking with Destiny. And I now understand the subtitle completely as a result of reading the book. I have to say, I don't know of a character in the 20th century and perhaps before that like him. He truly seems unique. Is that fair?
I think that is fair, yes, because so many areas of statesmanship that he touched, so many areas of life that he touched. You're quite right. It is difficult. Maybe Queen Elizabeth I. You'd have to go back really to the 17th century and 16th century to come across somebody in British history of the sheer sort of breadth as Winston Churchill.
Was she a character? Because he was a character.
Yes, yeah. I mean, we only have some of her more amusing, you know, lines, by and large. But, whereas he, of course, made a joke pretty much every day, didn't he?
His wit, the speed of his wit. There were times I laughed aloud. By the way, I actually read to my audience now twice, and I will regularly do it, his comment on exercise. the exercise I get is pall bearer at the funerals of my friends who exercised.
I know. He was never happier than when, as a sort of meat-eating, cigar-smoking, he's never happier than when somebody who was...
right. Some health fanatic died before him.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
It was a good chance for a joke there.
Now, I mean, and then the images of him dictating a wartime correspondence in his bathtub with a cigar.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, who is like that?
No. Yes, the eccentricity is extraordinary. You know, wearing zip-up shoes. Can you imagine anybody in the 1930s wearing... Because it saved him time from having to do shoelaces up.
You know, why hasn't that returned? It seems so practical.
Yeah, I know. Sounds like a good idea.
Yes, absolutely. Now, today... It would be impossible for a man to dictate letters in a bathtub. It would be considered sexual harassment.
Well, of course. No, absolutely. And, I mean, his female secretaries weren't actually in the room at the time. They were outside the door.
Okay. All right. Fine. So yeah, I had a wrong picture. Okay.
You have a slightly...
Yes. Okay. No. I'm very happy. The truth is, given Churchill's temperament, it wouldn't be out of the question.
No, nothing's impossible. Well, I mean, he met FDR when he was stark naked, of course, when FDR came in.
Yes. And yet he had such a sober assessment of the world while being an eccentric.
That's right, yes. As well as this series of hilarious eccentricities, he also had a statesman's view of the world and an incredibly careful summing up of the various sort of world powers and the interactions between them and everything else that you expect and require in a great statesman.
Do you know the single thing that struck me in your long and fascinating book was how often he cried?
Amazing, isn't it? I know you think of him as a buttoned-up Victorian aristocrat, but in fact he was a throwback, wasn't he, to an earlier era, a Regency era, where people wore their hearts on their sleeves much more than in the Victorian times.
Not only that, but we have this discussion in America today of what I think very destructive people call toxic masculinity. And you can't get more masculine than Winston Churchill, and the man cried regularly.
Yes, absolutely. He was not that stiff-upper-lip figure that one thinks of the Victorian.
And nobody thought less of him, apparently. You do not have any, or maybe I missed it, but I don't remember any example of people go, oh, there's Winston crying again.
No, well, Edward and Mrs. Simpson called him Crybaby, but other than that, there's nobody who... and that's quite an affectionate thing, I think. They didn't mean that in an unpleasant way. But other than that, no, people did appreciate that he was just built on a different scale to a different kind of era than the rest of them, really.
But I want my listeners to understand he was never crying for himself. He was crying because something touched him.
That's right. Yes. No. There's no element of self-pity in his tears. It's always for others.
Yes.
As his private secretary said, anything would touch him off, even a noble dog struggling through the snow to get to his master. A story like that would have Churchill blubbing in a matter of minutes.
You're right. No. That obviously, I don't think anybody who doesn't know him well, which is most people, would ever assume that of him. How many you will, by the way, it cracked me up because you know I'm a big cigar smoker. You estimated, or somebody estimated, that he had smoked, what, 180,000 cigars?
160,000, yes, in his life. I know. And it puts the rest of us to shame, really, doesn't it?
Oh, my God.
No, exactly.
I guess second.
He got given a lot of them, of course. I mean, he had to pay for them when he was a young man. But later on in his life, Americans, in particular, would inundate him and send him boxes of cigars. So he didn't have to pay for them, luckily.
Talking about America, he, on a very serious note, he was annoyed with America for not helping Britain more, or even ideally joining the battle against Hitler.
I think annoyed is a very
understated word
for what he felt. Yes, I think intense frustration, which he couldn't, of course, publicly state. And you get that, don't you, in the King's diaries, where Churchill was able to tell the King how frustrated he was that the Roosevelt administration wasn't moving closer towards actual outright bellicosity against Hitler. And yet, part of the frustration was the very fact that in public, of course, he had to keep that entirely buttoned up.
So, in the final analysis, if I read you correctly, he really became... he came to love Franklin Roosevelt.
He did, although, of course, the relationship did break down by the fall of 1944, when the sort of long-term interests of the American Republic did diverge from the British Empire, and there are some 200 more letters or telegrams from Churchill than there are replies from FDR, and so there you see a sort of a cooling of relations by that stage of the war, sadly.
I want to ask you about Stalin, the British Empire, but I just want to explain to my listeners, the walking with destiny is almost eerie. Please tell my listeners at what age he predicted he would save England.
Yes, he was 16. He was a schoolboy at Harrow. He said to his best friend that in his life he would see great troubles and terrible upheavals, and that he would be called upon to save London and save Britain and save the Empire. And he was literally 16 years old, exactly half a century before he had to do all of those things.
How do you explain that?
An extraordinary sense. I don't think it's possible to understand Winston Churchill without this sense of destiny. He believed that, in his words, there were invisible wings that were beating over him that saved him on any number of brushes with death throughout his life, that saved him for greater things, and in this case, saving London and Britain and the Empire.
Is that one of the reasons? Is it, I'll give you a sort of multiple choice. Is it A, one of the reasons? Is it B, the reason? Or C, no reason at all for why he was so physically courageous?
I think it's the most important reason. Am I allowed D as the answer to that?
Yes.
I think it's the most important reason. I think that his extraordinary physical courage came from a driving ambition, a knowledge that he never had enough money to buy a seat in Parliament, as you could do almost in those days. And so what he needed to do was to distinguish himself on the battlefield. On so many times, he fought in five campaigns on four continents, that Parliament would just have to have him because he was such a distinguished soldier. And so and the reason he wanted to do that was because of this driving sense of personal destiny and an attempt to vindicate his father as well, which is his long dead father.
Oh, you know what? Let me do that even before Stalin and the Empire. Is it fair to say that his father bordered on contempt for Winston?
Oh, didn't border on it. I think he went well over the well over it into on the verge of sort of utter disdain. Really, failed completely to spot any spark of sort of special nature in his son. He called his own son second or even third rate.
This is remarkable for those listening who believe in the significance of self-esteem in children. Here was a father who did everything possible to destroy any self-esteem in his son, and it had the opposite impact.
Yes, it's extraordinary. And he also loved his father. And
after his father died, that blew my mind. That blew my mind. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, after his father died in 1895, when his father was 45 and he was 20, Churchill went out of his way to visit his father's friends, to hear stories about him. He wrote his two-volume biography, over 1,000 pages long. He called his own son Randolph. He adopted his father's political views and quoted his father constantly in speeches. And really, in a sense, you can see the rest of his life being an attempt to impress the shade of his long-dead father.
How do you explain that?
I can't, really. I don't believe in psychobabble in books.
You know, no, you don't.
Let books down.
That's
badly,
right.
Really. So I let the reader try and work it out for themselves, I suppose.
But no one would ever have expected the contempt. And tell about the mother. The mother, what was too busy enjoying life to really be a mother?
Yes, exactly. And this is so unusual and unexpected because, of course, she was American. She came from Brooklyn. One was expecting her, therefore, to be a mother who looked after her and adored her children. Instead, she took no notice of them whatsoever. In 1884, the first 6 months of 1884, when Winston was nine and his younger brother Jack was six, she only saw them for 6.5 hours in those 6 months. Otherwise, she was pursuing her party lifestyle. She was a great beauty, a high society socialite, really.
She had affairs, correct?
Oh, yes, with the Prince of Wales and with the Austrian ambassador and with several of the sort of hunting set in Edwardian England.
So, Winston Churchill is raised by a father who has utter contempt for him and tells him so, and by a mother who never sees him.
Yeah.
Forgive me, Andrew. And turns out not just to be Winston Churchill, but turns out to be a loving friend, a kind personal human being, and a monogamous, faithful, loving husband.
Yeah, and a good father. And so all in all, he does exactly the opposite of what modern psychologists will tell you is going to happen, basically. And he writes of his mother, wonderful moving line in his autobiography, My Early Life. He said that she shone for me like the evening star, brilliant, but at a distance.
Wow.
Isn't that sad? Such a sad thing to have to write about oneself, really.
He also had utter magnanimity toward people who were his foes.
Yes, he didn't believe in... He thought it was bad to keep in the bile. He believed it was much better under all circumstances, whether he'd beaten them or lost to them, to become friendly afterwards. I mean, not obviously foes like Adolf Hitler or...
British political foes.
British political foes, yeah.
Yes.
He didn't believe in taking politics to the extent of destroying friendship.
You know, between the Churchill biography and a certain level of friendship with me, I don't understand why you're not into cigars more.
I smoke a cigar whenever I can.
What does that mean?
Well, whenever, it's usually when I'm in black tie at the end of an evening and I've got a glass of brandy and someone offers me one, I never say no.
Also, you pretty much have adopted Churchill's attitude. So long as people supply you with cigars, you'll smoke them.
I'm certainly not going to smoke 160,000
of them. Even I won't. That's correct. He probably woke up and went to bed with a cigar. It was ubiquitous.
He had one on the go pretty much all the way through the day, exactly. And he used to take the bands off them and put the band on his little finger like it were a ring.
Yeah.
And you see lots of photographs of him with his enormous ring, and of course it turns out to be a cigar.
Oh,
band.
God, is that funny? That is so Churchillian. All right, on a totally serious and troublesome note. Did I read you correctly that he adopted an affection for Joseph Stalin?
He said, "I like that man," to Anthony Eden. He knew it was wrong to. He only met Stalin on 5 occasions in a total of less than a month in his life. And, of course, he was the first person to denounce Stalin and Stalinism after the war at the Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri in March 1946. But having said all of that, you're quite right. It is troubling because he did have an affection for him at the time of the Potsdam Conference in July 1945. And by that stage, he knew about the Katyn massacre of the Polish officers in the war. He knew about what he had himself written in an essay was the daily budget of executions, as he put it, that Stalin was responsible for in the Great Terror before the war. So it is, as you say, it's a troubling and sort of weird attitude for him to have taken, considering he was such a...
In his writing about the war after the war, did he comment on Stalin in any way? Or because he was very self-aware, did he didn't?
Yeah. No, the problem was, of course, that Stalin was still in office.
Yeah, till 53.
Till his death in March 53. And the first three volumes of that great six-volume book came out before March 53. So he was very, and he was prime minister, of course, at, for some part of the of the of the publication of those books. So he had to really tread a fairly tight line, because it was basically the British head of government talking about the Russian head of state.
So did you infer anything about Stalin? In other words, was Stalin charming?
No, I think he was chilling. And I've met two or three people who knew Stalin and worked with Stalin, the British ambassadors at the time. And they all say that everyone around Stalin was always in a constant state of terror and paranoia about, well, not paranoia, because, of course, paranoia is...
irrational.
Is irrational, whereas it's wholly rational to be scared of Stalin if you're one of his ministers. But, of course, that didn't apply to Churchill. What Churchill did like was his capacity for decision making. Once Stalin made up his mind, he stuck to whatever it was that he'd what he'd agreed. But what he also did, I'm afraid, was to put a sort of, and this is part of the drinking thing. He would stay up late at night drinking with Stalin, and there was therefore a sort of camaraderie over the bottle that that tended to last. When, in a way, of course, he should have recognised that everything Stalin, the most cynical man other than perhaps Hitler in history, was doing, was to try to lull the West into a full sense of security.
Is it true, did I get you right in the book, that when Churchill would put up the two fingers for victory, Stalin interpreted it as a second front against Russia?
Either that or slightly more complex, the Soviet propagandists decided that that's how they were going to interpret it. You can't really tell, of course, with the
what they actually believed, yeah.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Still, it's,
yeah.
The two fingers mean a second front against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean...
cracked me up, I have to say. I will be back in a, back in a moment with Andrew Roberts and... as you can see, it's just, it's so interesting. The best way, to, by the way, if you care, if you take my word seriously about history, the best way to learn it most, I think, accessible is through biography. All right, everybody, Dennis Prager here, speaking with the British historian Andrew Roberts, and I thoroughly enjoyed I lived his book. I was sad it was over, and it's a very big book. How many words is your book?
460,000.
It is? It's that big?
Yeah, it's, I know it is. But that includes all the
footnotes.
You know, footnotes and the bibliography and the index. You don't have to read the entire 460,000.
So I just read a 400,000-word book?
Yeah.
I can't believe that's such a credit to you.
Well, you know, I've been getting loads and loads of emails, literally scores of them, saying that from people who complain it's too short, and that they wished it, by the time they got to the end, they wished it were longer.
It's funny. I understand that, because the end is briefly described. I want to talk to you about that in a moment. But all right, so we did Stalin. There was the other thing that I really, really. I'm grateful to be able to talk to you. You know, most people don't have access to authors, and I never take it for granted. It came through to me that he fought for the British Empire pretty much as he fought for Britain.
Absolutely. absolutely right, yes. It was his secular religion, really, all the way through his life, from the moment that he went out as a young subaltern into the northwest frontier of India to protect the British Raj, British rule in India, all the way through to the last words that he said as Prime Minister, were all about his belief in the civilizing mission and the positive aspects of the British Empire.
Which I have to say, and I have no vested interest here. I'm not a Brit, but
no, I know. But you're a pretty serious Anglophile, Dennis. I have to say that. You've got it bad, old boy.
I have never been called an Anglophile in my life. That is so far. If I'll tell you this, if I were an Anglophile, it would have been killed in my year in Leeds. I think it was knocked out of me. So I'm not sure I suffer from that. I'm not so much an Anglophile as a civilizationophile, and I believe that the Brits have made a major contribution to the toughest thing in the world, and that is making good civilization. And I don't know if one thinks in terms of good and bad rather than imperialist, non-imperialist, or colonialist, not colonialist. Why is there an argument against his notion that there was a civilizing power in the British Empire in India?
Well, that's right. I mean, when you look at what the British did there, doubling the life expectancy, bringing eight times more of the land under cultivation, getting rid of horrific practices like sati, the throwing of widows onto dead husbands' funeral pyres, everything we did with regard to railways and irrigation, and bringing universities in for the first time, internal peace, protecting the oceans to allow free trade, largest free trade area, and all of that. It's the way in which, since the 1960s, the largely Marxist or Marxoid philosophers of the left have managed to turn the British Empire into something uniquely evil, seems to be an extraordinary thing to me.
Good. I don't, as I said, I think in terms of good and evil. And the net good of the Brits in India is so obvious to me that one has to have a broken moral compass. There wouldn't be an India without Britain. It would be a bunch of competing, non-related states.
You certainly wouldn't have one with the Westminster democratic system and the parliament and the rule of law in the way that it has. You know, the whole of the Indian legal system comes from the common law of Britain. And you also wouldn't have had it as a unitary country. As you say,
that's what I said.
Exactly. Yes. You'd never have had the Punjab, for example, in the same country as Bengal. It just simply
exactly
did not happen.
Yeah, he was sort of the Garibaldi of India.
Yes, no, exactly. So you can understand why Churchill believed that this was worth fighting for and
yes,
worth defending.
Yes.
And the way in which, and he foresaw the terrible massacres that took place between Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus up on the northwest frontier in 1947 and 1948. And he warned that this was going to happen. And the Labour government took no notice of him. And as a result, something like 750,000 people were killed.
He had, if I read you correctly, he was not an admirer of Gandhi.
No. Some of his most sort of notorious remarks and you know, famous quotable sayings were those directed against Gandhi, who, of course, today, especially in India, is considered something like a secular saint.
But he wasn't.
He wasn't.
The more I know about Gandhi, the more I agree with Churchill.
Well, do you know, just the other day, I don't know if you noticed, in the Gambia, in a university in the Gambia, Gandhi's statue was taken down because of the racist remarks that he had made about black Africans. Everything needs to be seen, with regard to this question of race and identity, in terms of its proper historical perspective. It means absolutely nothing if you can't put it in the proper context.
That's exactly what I spoke about last hour. I get a lot of my wisdom from the Bible, and Noah is described as a righteous man in his generations. You can only judge people in their generations.
Precisely. It means nothing otherwise. I mean, you might as well ask what Oliver Cromwell would think about, you know, socialized medicine. It means makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, he probably thinks what I think of it. But that's a separate issue. I'll be back. Final segment coming up. It's too bad. It's like it's sort of like candy for me. Speaking with Andrew Roberts. His book on Churchill is up at DennisPrager.com. Hello, my friends. With great sadness that I say this is the final segment of the hour, because I enjoy speaking with Andrew Roberts as much as I do. So much. And he is the author, most recently, of this magnificent biography of Winston Churchill, who is simply a fascinating human being. And you live his life with this book. Finally, is a very interesting element to Churchill's life. As you point out, he was the one Judeophile in the British leadership. How do you explain that?
Well, in a sense, it was it came from his father. This one positive aspect that his father did bequeath him was a sense, as you say, of liking Jews. He went on holiday with Jews when he was young. He represented a Jewish constituency early on. Of course, he became a Zionist and supported the Balfour Declaration. So he had an early warning system, basically, that about Hitler and the Nazis, that was not given to many of the anti-Semites who sat near him in the Conservative Party on the House of Commons benches. He was able to see it for what it was early on, because he liked Jews.
A disturbing element in your discussion of that was the ubiquity of anti-Semitism in the British elite. Is that correct?
Yes, it was, I'm afraid, complete. It was a bacillus that was out of control by the 1930s. It was a terrible thing, really. I mean, in some people, and of course we wouldn't have passed the Balfour Declaration in 1917 unless there was a small cadre of highly pro-Zionist people in the cabinet at that particular time. David Lloyd George, of course, being another one, as well as Balfour. But otherwise, the general ruck of Conservative MPs, I'm afraid anti-Semitism was just taken for granted, frankly.
The early warning system is the reason for the subtitle, if I may just mention, book that I wrote, Why the Jews. It is exactly that. The greatest predictor of human evil is anti-Semitism, and Churchill knew that.
Exactly. And he had it, he also appreciated, as he said in his article in 1920, that the Jews gave the greatest ethics to civilization. Judeo-Christian ethics,
right,
were ultimately for him what the world, what was worth fighting for.
In 10 seconds, did Churchill believe in God?
He believed in an almighty whose major task was to look after Winston Churchill.
That's great. What a joy. Andrew Roberts, thank you for your book and for your friendship.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy your podcast, take a moment, tell a friend to subscribe today.
three-star general, Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.